This is Bird Note. Setting up bird feeders and bird baths are great ways to attract birds to your yard. But they aren't the only ways to entice our feathered friends. Planting an area densely with native shrubs, trees, and other vegetation can create a natural look, one that some birds are more likely to feel at home in because it resembles their native habitat. Shy birds, such as thrushes or warblers, seem to feel safest if they can flit and sneak within continuous cover and not have to cross open expanses to move from one shrub to another. Add a bird bath or two close to the dense vegetation, and these shy birds can emerge from a thicket to bathe or drink and then dart safely into cover in an instant. And they'll repay you with their beautiful songs, like those of a fox sparrow. Or a thrush, like this veery. For tips on ensuring that your yard is not only inviting, but also safe for birds in every way, visit birdnote.org. I'm Mary McCann.
Do you like music, or do you like technology, or do you like talking to people? CGSF Radio is the place for you. Here at CGSF, the opportunities are endless. You can interview artists and bands, speak up for what you believe in, or even host your own show, and tons more. To find out more information, visit cgsf.ca.
You're listening to CJSF and 90.1 FM in Burnaby. CJSF is diverse, independent, and yours, sharing music and voices from genres and cultures around the world, reflecting you and the rest of your community. You make CJSF diverse.
It is only through a change in human consciousness that the world will be transformed. The personal and the planetary are connected. As we expand our awareness of mind, body, psyche, and spirit, and bring that awareness actively into the world, so also will the world be changed. This is our quest as we explore new dimensions.
What are the roots and consequences of perfectionism? And what are the pathways to overcome their toxic effects? Here, Dr. Tara Cousineau, a clinical psychologist, draws on her own experiences and research to show how perfectionism, often fueled out of a need for belonging and acceptance, leads to burnout, stress, anxiety, and a persistent sense of not being good enough. Perfectionism leaves us trapped in a loop of dissatisfaction and comparing ourselves with others. And today we'll be exploring the work of befriending ourselves with our guest, Tara Cousineau. Dr. Tara Cousineau is a clinical psychologist at Harvard University's Counseling and Mental Health Services. She's professionally trained in mind-body medicine, energy psychology, mindfulness, self-compassion, and other psychological methods. She's the author of The Kindness Cure, How the Science of Compassion Can Heal Your Heart and Your World, and The Perfectionist's Dilemma, Learn the Art of Self-Compassion, and Become a Happy Achiever. So please join us for the next hour as we learn how to break free of toxic perfectionism with our guest, Dr. Tara Cousineau. I'm speaking with Tara from her home by remote connection. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. I'll be your host. Welcome to New Dimensions. Tara, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Justine.
Oh, it's my pleasure and honor to have you on this very important subject that I know many of us are delving with in our lives. And I know that when you talk about perfectionism, you also talk about our inner algorithms. And I was very curious about how they relate, perfectionism and our inner algorithms. And what do you mean by inner algorithms?
Yeah, well, I work in an area in the country with lots of universities and colleges and high achievers. And algorithms is something that people just gravitate to. Oh, right, I've got this inner code, you know, and I can't change it, right? It's a pattern. It's just another way of saying an internal script, let's say. I like to refer to inner algorithms as parts as well. Like, we've got just these little parts of ourselves that basically we're born out of stressful situations at some point in our life, and then we find ways to cope. And those coping patterns become these algorithms, and we tend to repeat them over and over again, even when they're no longer helpful.
There was research that you mentioned in your writing, and it was an explanation of how we view life. And I'm going to read it because it just really knocked my socks off. You wrote, neuroscientists like to say that your day-to-day experience is a carefully controlled hallucination. I love that. Constrained by the world and by your body, but ultimately constructed by your brain. So in other words, like false evidence appearing as real.
Yes. So that, I find that some of the brain science really just confirms some of the things that we know from ancient wisdom, first of all. But it's nice to have a little bit of data. And that phrase that you refer to is that our life is like basically like we're living a hallucination. The way I like to think about it and explain it, I work with so many students, is that our brain kind of is like a Netflix recommendation engine. Right? You keep doing the same thing or selecting the same thing. You know, you love comedies. Guess what? Your entire Netflix recommendation are going to be comedies and comedies. But what if you want to see an action film or a thriller or a romance? You actually have to input that data in order for that algorithm to change. Well, it's the same thing actually with our brains. Is if we want to have more love or forgiveness or I don't know, we want to change our life in some way, we actually have to put ourselves in the situations that are going to allow that to flourish and that to grow. But what the brain will do is very efficient. It will already predict for you what's going to happen next. And it doesn't have to be that way.
All right. It's predicting. That's the hallucinatory
part. That's the hallucination part.
Right.
Yes.
That it predicts something that may or may not be true. I think of the work of Byron Katie, you know, is this true? You know, I think it's one of her phrases.
Right. She's got the four questions. And what's the evidence out there? Is it true? Is it really true? Right. Because we have to actually constantly look for that kind of that evidence. And often people will have sort of biases and they won't even see the evidence that's in front of them.
Right. It can be invisible. Perfection is, it has an honorable intention, but with unintended consequences. So please speak to that.
Well, absolutely. I say to people who come into my office and they lament, well, this is my perfectionism, and they're kind of down on themselves. At the same time, they know that it's gotten them this far in life. And I'm like, listen, perfectionism is protection. It's a coping strategy that you use when you were 5, 8, 10, 14, because you knew that if you just did things right, you wouldn't get in trouble, you wouldn't get punished, you'd get accepted by friends. And there's so many reasons for us to almost become compulsive about doing the right thing, becoming people pleasers. And those are patterns, and they worked. They were survival strategies. But what happens over time, after whatever, 10 years, 20 years, you're still doing that same compulsive striving when it's no longer necessary. And in fact, there is some research that shows, especially when you're in the pursuit of goals, is that there's a tipping point. There's this inflection point where you're striving for perfection or excellence is going to backfire. In fact, you're more prone to making mistakes. So we need to kind of catch ourselves when we're on that trajectory. There is absolutely nothing wrong with the value of striving for excellence, wanting high quality, wanting to do great things in the world, having passion. These are wonderful things, but you can drop the suffering along with it.
Exactly. And so you mentioned excellence. So if we drop our need for perfection, we're not necessarily dropping our need for excellence. Am I getting
exactly that? Right. Yeah. So I think what happens when, and why, workplace research shows that people report that perfectionism is their favorite flaw, you know, on interviews. Although now people are wising up to that because they think that it's a good flaw to have, because that means that you're going to work extra hours and work really hard and all of that. And really what the research shows is that perfectionists do no better than non-perfectionists. So why all the extra effort when it's causing more suffering? And suffering can look like burnout, for sure, not enjoying your life, not being home to, you know, have dinner with your kids. And there are all sorts of things that can come along with this unremitting striving that is really a sacrifice. It's not an enhancement in your life.
I'm thinking, I know in your work that you talk about if we're going to address our suffering of perfectionism, if we're going to address it, that it's, we can't talk our way out of it. It's not like about talk therapy. You talk about it's a body thing. It's like going down into the body. So I'd love for you to describe that.
Yes, I don't know if my fellow psychologists would agree. So for me, you know, coming from a more mind-body approach, traditionally, like with talk therapy, most of therapy is very cognitive. We are reviewing life stories and memories. We're focusing on reframing the negative, replacing negative thoughts with more positive thoughts. And that's all well and good, but it doesn't sustain over time. Really, what we need to connect with is our bodies and how this is manifested in our nervous system. And, you know, our nervous system doesn't talk. Our nervous system senses. And so when the nervous system senses, oh, there's a threat, like given that presentation, for example, your body's sensing, oh no, there's a warning signal. What if this goes terrible? And if we're just trying to say, oh, okay, you can do it, you can do it. I mean, that can be helpful, but if you're not calming the nervous system, it's not really going to help. So I sometimes get frustrated with a lot of the mindset coaching. Because I always say if people could change their minds, they would. But it's our minds that kind of trip us up along the way. So in this book, which I feel like is a little bit off the beaten path, and I don't ignore the evidence base for certain psychological interventions that are helpful, like CBT or dialectical behavior therapy. I mean, you know, they're all useful and helpful, but I often feel that they neglect the body part. And when I see a perfectionist walk into my office or online, I pretty much sense right away their tension. Like they're just like, they're almost like talking heads. They're like, there's no connection between their head and their body. And they're so good at controlling their lives and their feelings that there's a disconnection that happens. And so I hope to help them reconnect.
So I hear you saying that the body can really be tremendously helpful in this whole process by feeling the impressions in of the body. And I, so that leads me to, okay, fine. So I'm feeling something's going on, my stress, and you ask me, okay, well, where do you feel it in your body? And I say, oh, well, I feel it in my stomach. It's just so tense. Well, okay, fine. Feeling it in my stomach, now what do I do with it?
I think there's a deeper inquiry, but that's a really good point, Justine, because, yeah, first, it's helping people sense that, oh, I'm feeling really tense, or I'm feeling constriction in my heart, or my heart is racing rapidly, or I feel nauseous, or I feel tingling in my fingers. I think that's such a great place to start. And then to say, well, what part of you is feeling this? Right, to really, so this is where we start to get into the algorithms or the parts. And people are fairly natural at saying, well, there's a part of me that is really afraid that I will get humiliated, or that people will find me out, that I'm not really as smart as people think I am. So now we're starting to connect some dots between the body and the brain. And then there's a question like, well, how long has this been going on? Or, you know, can you think back to a time in your life that you first started to notice this? And sometimes people are like, no, it's just the way that I am, right? And so what I'm trying to do is help them kind of disconnect from this idea, well, this is just the way that I am, and help them see, no, it's actually a part or a pattern or a script, however you want to call it, honestly. And to get really curious about that. And then the inquiry goes a little bit deeper. Well, how do you think that this part is trying to help you? Is there a positive intention to this sensation, this emotion, this thought? And that really flips people out. They're like, what do you mean a positive intention? Like, you know, is that inner critic trying to help you in some way? What would the reason be? And then people, when they're open to playing with this, are like, well, yeah, I think it's trying to help me so that I don't experience that shame. And so it's working really hard for me. Like, oh, okay, that makes sense. And then they start getting curious. And, you know, and this is going a little bit into a technique or an area of psychology that I really love, which is internal family systems, is to understand that, oh, this pattern, it's serving a purpose. It's not trying to undermine you. And a lot of people try to get rid of that inner critic. And I'm like, no, no, no. We can't get rid of that part. It's serving some sort of function for you. Let's get really curious about what that is first.
And I love that work. And that was created by Richard C. Schwartz, who has been interviewed on New Dimensions.
Oh, IFS. Wonderful.
Internal family systems, and it's quite elegant. And this just reminds me, one of the three areas of the parts that he mentions and that you mention are our manager self, our firefighter self, and our exile self. And I love those. And I came up when I got to the exile self. Oh, my God, Tara, I really related to that. That is my preferred coping strategy. Just, I call her Irma out of here. I'm Irma, I'm out of here. And I just like disappear. I just say, I'm out of here. And in fact, I just experienced that recently where I signed up for a women's retreat to get to know some women in a particular group that I was just recently joining. And I was a newbie. And so I went to the retreat. And I looked over it was in a rustic setting, and I looked over where I was going to be staying and everything and talked to the people. And I just freaked out. And Irma rose up like you would not believe. And even though I paid for the whole the retreat, I got back in my car and I was out of there. I was shocked. And so when I was looking at your book and I thought, oh, that's a pattern. And I recognize it. as a real live living pattern within
yes.
me.
Yeah.
And so you are helpful in so far as to name it and to recognize it. And now what? Now
yeah.
Tara, now what do I do with that?
Well, call me up and we can have a session. You know, so perfectionism is a manager part, right? Most, you know, so when we think about trying to do things right and people pleasing and performing and having to do that, that's a part that's trying to manage our lives so that we can succeed and achieve in some way. A firefighter part is really, it's trying to offer relief pretty quickly. I mean, I would almost guess that part that you talked about is a firefighter that just got you out of danger, you know, and that there's actually probably, you know, another exile part, a younger part that's hiding out. And so that there was a part of you that just said, this feels really unsafe. You can't be here. Let's hightail it out of here. And it's so good that you're aware of that. And I'd be so curious, you know, if you could reflect or journal, write, speak to that part of you, that Irma, I'm out of here part, and get to know it and how it's been serving you in some way, and whether there might be possibilities for other ways, you know, connect with that part, have that part know that you, Justine, are here and that you can run the show.
Yeah.
You know, and not that part necessarily, but it could be an exile part too. I mean, it's part of, you know, it's interesting questions and to be curious and really have a lot of hold that with a lot of compassion, because I bet that Irma, I'm out of here part, you know, you say it's a pattern, it's been around for a long time, and I would be so curious, like, yeah, when did it show up in your life? How do you experience that in your body? You know, how might you turn towards that part? I think that's what Richard Schwartz has, this sort of languaging around. It's not like, you know, trying to get rid of that part or have it snap out of anything. It's like really turning towards these parts. And it's the same thing with the perfectionist part. It's turning toward it and saying, oh my gosh, you have done a really good job for me so far. And now we're going to try a different way. You know, and experiment with it is help that part unburden. Like that's the deeper work with IFS, is that you help those parts unburden, and that can take a little bit of time. And so I feel like that's a lens with perfectionism that I introduce. I feel like, oh, that was baby IFS. That was IFS 101 that I was adding into the book, but it draws on building on that mindfulness and that self-compassion. It really does require to be compassionate towards the parts that you don't want to look at.
So you encourage us to, number one, name it, to give it a name, like let's say our inner critic, to give it a name, and then to befriend it, to invite it in for a cup of tea.
Yeah. Well, that you know, inviting your critic in for a cup of tea comes from the great meditation teacher, Jack Kornfield. I had done a meditation teacher training with him, and there was someone in the audience who was so distraught and so angry. This was around the time of the hurricane in Puerto Rico, and it was so devastating. And, you know, this person was just really kind of almost like wailing, and it was so uncomfortable to witness. And he just said, and this is such a good teaching for me, I remember it all the time. He said, you know, when these difficult feelings arise, like anger, frustration, rage, invite it in like a guest, turn towards it and say, anger, I see you. Come sit, have a cup of tea. Oh, it's just like, it still gives me the chills just even remembering that moment. And it's the same thing with turning towards these parts of us that cause us disruption, self-sabotage. Can we turn towards it with that kind of spaciousness and an invitation? And that takes a little bit of resilience, right? It means having some tolerance for distress, which people want to avoid. Hence, the firefighters show up.
Yeah, yeah. And I think the firefighter part also, I think you talk about that is it can lead to addictions. That is that right?
This is what a lot of the experts in this area talk about, and I believe that this is true, is that fighting behavior is pain relief. And we can't help trying to find ways to relieve the pain. All animals do this. And if we can see that retail therapy, drinking, you know, whatever risky behavior that might be, that distractions, doom scrolling, you know, all of that are distractions from something that's uncomfortable. And that's a kind of, I think, a different way of looking at things. And the healers who focus on this really are wonderful guides around this. With perfectionism, there's this polarity, if you will, a polarization of the perfectionist part and the procrastinating part.
Oh,
right?
No.
It's so common. I mean, I feel like that's almost primarily my work with Harvard students. You know, they come into the office and they have all these ideals and they're, you know, and they want to work really hard and do really great things, and then they can't do it. You know, there's every possible excuse, or they shut down. And I can see it as two opposing inner parts, two algorithms that are misaligned in some way. And so one part's looking for the relief, right? The procrastinator. I mean, procrastination is just a failure avoidance strategy.
Yeah, right. I think we can all relate.
Yeah. And I do that too. I go, you know, I was raised by a German mother, you know, when there's something hard to do, I'll go clean the house, you know, I can't help it, you know, and that's a total avoidance strategy. It makes me feel better in the moment. Meanwhile, I still have all this work to do, you know, very, very common.
I have to write this grant, but I'd rather just scroll through my email.
Exactly.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, so common. And I think so, you know, one of the things that I say is notice, name, and nurture. So it was noticing the behavior in the first place, right? Or the feeling or the sensation. Just notice it, name it. You know, and the naming part is like the fun part, I think. I try to bring a lot of, you know, playfulness into this. I have sort of a part that's been around a really long time. I was a temper tantrum kid. I was really a handful, you know, all that early childhood stuff, parents divorced, complete chaos, domestic violence. I mean, I could, you know, all those adverse childhood experiences, but I really had a temper. And I call that part Scarlet, after Scarlett O'Hara and Gone with the Wind. Just, you know, oh, so could just be so difficult. And she shows up every once in a while. I mean, I would consider that an exile part who's healed, but she still shows up. Unfair elections, you know, reading the news, things feel really unjust. And I get very, very agitated. And now I've come to a place in my life where I'm like, oh, okay, Scarlett, I know. This really is awful. This is devastating. I hear you. And then I pull on one of the skills to calm, right? To calm the nervous system, to calm that threat response that Scarlett is responding to. But what naming does, it gives a little bit of distance. Like, I am not Scarlett, but Scarlett is a part of me.
Right. I have when I got to that part, I named that part of me that kind of instantaneously rises up in angrily with kind of a fierce anger. And I named her Tawanda Wolf. And Tawanda is from that movie Fried Green Tomatoes. Oh, yes. And the main character would often say, Tawanda, as she would go crash into a parked car that took her parking space, yeah. You know. That's what I named mine. But just noticing that anger can just flare up, and you're saying to be easeful with it. Not act out then, but to take a pause and just say, oh, hi, Tawanda Wolf. Thank you for coming. You're protecting me now. And maybe you need to relax a little bit or whatever. What?
Yeah, absolutely. This is where the self-compassion piece, the subtitle of the book is, learn the art of self-compassion and become a happy achiever. Self-compassion can be a very tall order for a lot of people. They have a hard time relating to it.